Great to see so many of you. This is an amazing turnout. So I am Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, and I am thrilled tonight to be joined by the Reverend William Barber, who really needs no introduction, but I'll give him a quick introduction anyway. One of the nation's preeminent civil rights leaders, founder of North Carolina Moral Mondays Movement, president of Repairers of the Breach, and co-founder of the Poor People's Campaign. Reverend Barber, please come out.
Roll it together. Roll it together.
So Reverend Barber told me that he just got back from Liverpool, and I think you in Berkeley, it's like the Beatles in Liverpool, get the same kind of reception out here. And I've got to say, as a nice Jewish boy, I'm getting a real kick out of interviewing a reverend in a church.
Can I make it so you don't look like a flower?
Please, please. Thank you. Thank you. Always consider it. So we first met in North Carolina in 2013 when you were leading the Moral Mondays movement, which is just a remarkable movement that we're going to talk a little bit more about. Challenging the right-wing agenda in the South. And what's been amazing to me is just to watch your message go national and global, really. But I'm sure all of you guys saw Reverend Barber's speech at the Democratic Convention in 2016 when he just blew the roof off the place. And you said that America had a heart problem. And I think we all feel like that heart transplant is needed more than ever today. And now you are resurrecting the last major movement that Dr. Martin Luther King did before he died, the Poor People's Campaign. So I just want to start there with a little history. You were born 2 days after the March on Washington. Can you talk about what King meant to your family and what he eventually meant to you?
Well, first of all, Ari, thank you. And thank the pastor of this church and Mother Jones and all of the people here in the Bay Area for such a humbling welcome. And because I do organizing, let me just say @RevBarber is the Twitter. And if you want to hook up with the Poor People's Campaign, text ACTION to 90975. Text ACTION to 90975. 2 days before the March on Washington. And the story of my family is that my mother went into labor, and I said, wait a minute, there's a march going on. And Kennedy doesn't really want it to happen, and America's not that happy. Let's see what happens. And so 2 days later, I was born. My parents left Indiana and went back to the South by invitation to be a part of the team that would help desegregate schools. By the way, that did not happen in the county I stay in until 1970. I went to segregated first kindergarten and first grade.
15 years after Brown versus Board of Education.
15 years after. People have to understand, we're not talking about ancient history. 17 days after I was born, 4 girls were blown up in a church. About a month and a half before I was born, on June 12th, a little over a month and a half, Mega Evers was killed. Just a few months later, Kennedy. But the atmosphere began with George Wallace as a governor, loosing the rhetoric that was tied to racist policy. It wasn't just the rhetoric. It was the rhetoric connected to a policy's agenda, segregation yesterday, today, and forever. So I was born in a year of tears. I used to cry a lot, still do. And one day I had a talk with a counselor, and he said, because your mother carried you through so much So there was so much crying in 63 and then in 64. The Poor People's Campaign was 68, and there's several mistakes we make when we remember it. All right, I want to correct. Number one is that Dr. King didn't start talking about poverty until 68, 67. It's not true. When he was at Dexter Avenue in Montgomery, he preached a sermon entitled Paul's Letter to the American Christian. And he talked about how the 1% was running roughshod over the 99%. Dr. King saw civil rights as economics. In the March on Washington, it was not about kumbaya, we're all getting together. It was a march for jobs and justice. He talked about the check coming back marked insufficient funds. At the end of the Selma to Montgomery march, and his speech at the Capitol in Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama, he talked about how down through history, every time there was the possibility of black poor people and white poor people forming an alliance, as it was right after slavery, he said, the white slave aristocracy or the Bourbon crowd always sows division. So it is a misnomer to say Dr. King wasn't talking about economics. What he did do in 67 is he connected militarism, that by the way, Coretta was ahead of him, the sister. She was ahead of Dr. King on Vietnam. He connected the triune evils of militarism, poverty, and racism, and democratic socialism. And he said that till America dealt with those three things simultaneously, that America might, his last sermon was going to be, go to hell. That's exactly what he said. He was feeding off of a book at that time written that was entitled The Other America. And oftentimes between 67 and 68, he would start his speeches talking about there's this one America that's full of milk and honey and opportunity, but then there's this other America. And Dr. King saw that there was this need to unite the anti-war movement, anti-poverty movement, and the civil rights movement. And a lot of people left him. After the 67 speech at Riverside on militarism, and he talked about poverty in that speech, civil rights organizations left him. The one I loved, the NAACP, wrote a resolution against him. Churches left him again. Labor left him. 100-some-odd newspapers wrote articles against him, including black newspapers. But he kept on. And in 67 of December, he announced the need for the Poor People's Campaign in a speech called The Meaning of Hope. He then pulled a group together, and this is the last thing we have to correct. It wasn't just Dr. King. It was Dr. King, the Jewish Federation. It was Cesar Chavez. It was the National Welfare Rights Workers. They were the ones coming together to build this new and unsettling force. And the goal was to go to Washington, D.C., and to stay there until transformation. And the Poor People's Campaign didn't end. It didn't fail. It was shot. It was murdered. And they still had some successes. Mary Wright Edelman was the key to the policy, along with Dorothy Cotton, who just died a few days ago. So there's so much that we have not heard. And he was saying to America, if you don't get these three issues right, the project will always be flawed, faltering, and failing. And 50 years later, we've done an audit called the Souls of Poor Folk Auditing America 50 Years After the Poor People's Campaign. We don't have 39 million poor people in America. We have 140 million poor and low wealth people. We have 73% of them are women and children. We have 37 million people without health care. We have 4 million families that can buy unleaded gas but can't get unleaded water. We're spending $600 billion in war, twice what we were spending in Vietnam, and 50 cents of every discretionary dollar is going into war. We have the majority of poor people are white in raw numbers. In percentage of race is black, but the majority of poor people are white, even though poverty since the death of King was racialized as a way of distracting us from the real issue.
So why do you think that I mean, you're a reverend and a bishop now. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that issues like abortion and gay marriage have dominated in the evangelical community instead of issues like poverty and social justice?
Well, you know, I have to talk in a certain tongue. So I don't call what many people promulgate as evangelicalism because it's not. It's some kind of religious nationalism because I'm an evangelical. So that's the first thing. And according to this little Bible, the evangelicals are supposed to follow the Bible. There are 2,000 scriptures in this Bible that say that real faith is how you deal with the poor, the undocumented, the sick, and the least of these. There's only about 2 or 3 scriptures that deal with homosexuality, and they are misinterpreted and never looked at through the lens of love. So what you have is a heretical form of theological malpractice promulgating itself as evangelicalism. And that's why when you hear them talk, you never hear them say Jesus is for taking health care or Jesus is against the gay community. They don't say that. Doing that little sweeping off the floor, this, you know, kind of getting that debris out the way. We act as though this is new. Pharaoh always has false prophets. Jesus had to deal with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The slave masters had their own religion. And they used and misused and abused scripture to justify the genocide of indigenous people, Native American slaves and women and poor whites. In the 1900s, around 1935, according to Kevin Cruz's book, One Nation Under God, part of this mess came from California. Because the business community, Sun Oil, General Motors, the National Chamber of Commerce, came to Los Angeles and hired a guy by the name of James Fifield, who pastored the Congregationalist Church of Millionaires, who had come up with a gospel that he said he deboned the gospel and came up with this weird theology. If you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. If you're good, you're rich and middle class. If you're bad, you're poor. And they hired him and paid him in 1935 because they hated the New Deal. And they didn't have the moral credibility to come against it because the social gospel movement was so strong. So the only way they could do it was they had to go out and purchase the pulpit. They gave him enough money, and in 10 years he had 19,000 purchased pulpits. That's the ancestry of the so-called religious right, the moral majority. And after Dr. King was killed, there was an intentionality. We are never again going to allow morality in the public square to be about poverty, race, and those issues. We're going to limit it to prayer in the school, abortion, and being anti-gay and pro-gun and tax cuts and anti-immigrant. It is Christian nationalism, religious nationalism. It is heresy in the 21st century. Right? And that heresy has made its way all the way up now to the White House. But it's not new. Because the only way you can have a country, last thing I make, that subjugates and enslaves people for 250 years and commits genocide against Native people, you have to have 4 things to line up. Bad biology that says people are different because of their biological realities. Evil economics, make the money any way you can. Sick sociology, that people can't be around each other because of the differences of their race. But that 4th thing you have to have is heretical ontology, a false claim that God made it like this.
So we first met in North Carolina in the summer of 2013, when you were head of the North Carolina NAACP and you were leading the Moral Monday movement. Mm-hmm. And it was really remarkable. Hundreds of people got arrested, and it really grew into this statewide movement that I don't think anyone at least I didn't anticipate at the beginning. And you talked earlier about how the South was racially polarized, how they divided people among race. But one of the things that I thought was so amazing about that movement is you were able to get beyond that racial divide. You were able to get beyond everyone's pet issue, where the women's groups are in one corner and the environmental people are in the other corner and the NAACP is in the other corner. You were able to bring all of these people together to protest beyond race and beyond one single issue. How are you able to do that in the South?
We took a page from the Reconstruction movement right after the end of the Civil War, when poor blacks and poor whites came together, because the poor whites found out that the white aristocracy, slave aristocracy, had used them too. And most people don't know that, but by 1868, almost every Southern legislature was controlled by a large black contingency. Some of it was predominantly black, and whites, who formed Reconstruction. And it was fusion Reconstruction. They had a multiple set of issues. So in 2007, before you met me, when Democrats were in office, we looked at five issues: systemic racism, poverty, ecological issues, even how the war was impacting state politics. We looked at military spending, because we're a military state. And we developed a 14-point agenda with 81 action steps in 2007. And we began to work together. And the first thing we did, Rogers, we had a teach-in, and over 5,000 people showed up. Democrats were in office. But we said, we still have over a million poor people in this state. We still don't have same-day registration and early voting. We began to go down the list and show people how they were connected. Press forward. Well, we won. The first year we came together, we won same-day registration, early voting. The next year, President Obama runs. He loses on election day, but he wins because of the same-day registration, early voting. That's a story that isn't told that much. We were the first Southern state to raise the minimum wage that year when we came together. The legislator who had been pushing it 10 years, and it never got anywhere with Democrats in office. But once we said we weren't going to be Democrat, we weren't going to be Republican, we wanted to come with a moral agenda, a fusion moral agenda. Well, there was a lot of reaction to that. 2013, by that time, as you know, the North Carolina legislature, through voter suppression, through gerrymandering, had become veto-proof. Not Republicans, extremists. These were Tea Party extremists. My granddaddy was a Republican, so it's hard for me to call some of these people Republican. You know, my granddaddy was a Teddy Roosevelt, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, Eisenhower Republican. First 50 days, they did everything Trump is doing right now in North Carolina. We did everything we could. And then during Easter, Maundy Thursday, they passed a Senate bill called Senate Bill 666. And it literally rolled back about 40 voting provisions. And we decided if they were going to crucify the poor, crucify gay people, crucify women's rights, crucify the sick, they denied health care expansion for 500,000 people in North Carolina. Then they were going to crucify voting rights, then we had to have a moral witness. So we chose in April, the last 2 days of April, to go into the legislature, 17 of us, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, young, old, even a woman who was paraplegic in a wheelchair, had a multiple sclerosis. And we were planning on going one day. I have to be honest, we weren't planning on, because you know how we progressives do, we love to have one rally. We cuss everybody out at one rally and we go home and say, we did it. You know, and we were planning on Ari having one rally. And they arrested us. They brought 25 cops out. And the next Monday, twice as many people showed up. So the movement came. We had to catch up. We called it Moral Monday. It lasted for 14 weeks, starting with 17 people. By February, 100,000 people were in the street. The first summer, over 1,200 people were arrested. It lasted for 4 years. We then connected that fusion movement to a voter registration campaign. We then connected that to a fight back against voter suppression campaign. We beat them in the worst case after Shelby in voter suppression. We beat them on gerrymandering. We registered new voters across the state. We went from the mountains in the West Coast that's predominantly white to the East Coast predominantly black. And in 4 years later, the governor that created all of this got a vacation. In fact, in the first 6 weeks, we didn't know this till PPI, public polling, policy polling, that after the first 6 weeks of Moral Monday, focusing on issues and connecting these issues and connecting people together, the governor went from about almost 60% in the poll to under 40 and never recovered. When we changed the argument from being left versus right to being right versus wrong, and when we started letting people see that while the same people that were voter suppression were, when they used racism to get elected, but once they got elected, they were passing policies that were hurting mostly white people. In North Carolina, by denying voter Medicaid expansion, 340-some thousand of the people that were denied were white. But when they talked about it in the legislature, you would think it was just a bunch of lazy black and brown people that were going to get free health care. When we began to expose that in places like Appalachia, folk got it. Not because we went to them as Democrats or we went to them as Republicans, but we said it's time for statesmen and stateswomen to rise up with the moral agenda that can transform the consciousness of the state.
So you talked about the radicalism of the North Carolina Republican Party, the voter suppression, the gerrymandering, the attacks on healthcare, the attacks on women, the attacks on workers, pretty much every group,
yeah,
except themselves.
Right.
Do you think that this was a coming attraction for Trump? Were you surprised by Trump's election after seeing what the Republicans did in states like North Carolina?
What we saw in North Carolina, we saw how powerful it could work. We saw how that what gerrymandering could do, voter suppression could do, and then mixing that with fear and white rage and lies, it's a powerful poison. It's a poison that has often been placed in the veins of this American democracy. I knew that what Trump was doing was not new. I would listen to his stump speeches and then read George Wallace's 1968 speech in Madison Square Garden, and they sounded almost identical. If you ought to try it. I knew that the white Southern strategy that was beginning as the Poor People's Campaign was assassinated, that white Southern strategy started by Kevin Phillips and Richard Nixon was designed to last 50 years. It was designed to not talk with racist language, but to present policies that would have racist impact, dog whistle policies, anti-entitlement program, pro-tax cuts, sounding very economic, but underneath it was full of wedge issues to divide blacks and whites against each other. I knew that for years the white Southern strategy had locked up the South, and I knew that if you lock up from Maryland to Texas, the Southern states, over to Kentucky, that's 173 electoral votes, which means that's 14 states, which means you only need about another 90 some votes from the other, you need less than 90, you need about 87 votes from the other 36 states. I knew that when he came down that escalator, he was using the racist language, and I was amazed that the media didn't know how to call it what it was and how they played with it and how people did not understand it wasn't just rhetoric, it was a policy agenda. Because white nationalism has said that the first proxy war in America to be what they want the country to be is the war against immigrants. I knew that when we had 26 presidential debates, primary and general, and even in the Democratic debates, there was no real discussion about voter suppression. We didn't have an hour on fixing the Voting Rights Act. We didn't have an hour on poverty with 140 million people in poverty. I knew when we kept letting this stuff go, and when progressives tried to have this neoliberalism that's just gonna deal with working class folk and working class white people, which is a racist term in itself because it acts like there's no working class black people and working class brown people, I knew that we were making a classic error. And I knew enough from people like Neil Painter that there would have been no Trump without an Obama, because Obama, not that I agree with him on everything, but he represented a direct challenge to the white status quo power. And in every move of history, there was always a reaction to that, every time we stepped forward. So I knew that the stars were lined up, that it seemed that the and that's what I was trying to say to the Democratic Party that night, that this was bigger than left and right and Democrat and Republican. There couldn't be some pathway to victory through certain states. That we had this real serious heart issue, moral issue. I was hoping, and he really didn't win. He lost by 3 million votes. That has only happened two other times with Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877. He lost the popular vote and won by the electoral vote. He did the same thing Trump is doing, comparatively speaking. George Bush lost the popular vote, got in by the Supreme Court Electoral College. He takes us into wars we shouldn't have been in. So every time a candidate has lost the popular vote and won by the Electoral College, particularly the Electoral College that was driven by the Southern states, America has gone through some serious problems. So I'm saying that I was hurt that America would turn this way, that I was hurt that we live in a democracy still driven by a race-driven electoral college procedure where you can win 3 million more votes than the other candidate and lose. I was hurt when I read your book and saw the voter suppression all over this country, 900 and some fewer voter sites that you wrote about, the thousands of people that were denied, and that progressives really weren't talking about that. You know, we call Strom Thurmond a racist, and he only filibustered the Civil Rights Act of 57 for one day. Ryan McConnell and Boehner filibustered fixing the Voting Rights Act now for 5 years. And so Trump is not, for me, Trump is not the issue. Trump represents a malady. Trump and all of his enablers are it. He was enabled into the presidency by a backlash that too many people don't know how to talk about, didn't know how to talk about, haven't talked about. I wasn't surprised. I had hoped that it wouldn't happen, but it has happened before, and we are seeing it now, and it is dangerous. This quasi-white nationalist, neo-fascism, somewhat populist, you know, racist, and every time, you know, that he did say something racist or announced some policy that most of us knew was a racist policy, his numbers would go up. And somewhere, Ari, we're going to have to understand Trump benefited from a culture that was developed over 50 years. The white Southern strategy had a goal of it being lasting 50 years. This is the 50th year. We are in the middle of a third Reconstruction. We're either going to go real, real, real far backwards, or people are going to stand up and recognize that the reason we're being fought is not because we're weak, but because we're powerful. You mind if I stand up a second?
Please.
You got to stand up for this one.
This old knee. Yeah. Oh, I got to stand up for this one.
Uh-oh. Yeah, so let's talk about the Supreme Court.
Oh, Lord. Let me...
You got something you want to quote about that?
Yeah, I do. Isaiah chapter 10. Woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their right and make women and children their prey. Huh? Yeah, yeah. Let me see. You want to ask me that question? Before I do that, I need a little... Ezekiel 20, let me see. Your priests violated my law and desecrated my holy things. He said, your politicians are like wolves, prowling and killing and taking whatever you want. Your preachers cover up for the politician by pretending to receive visions and special revelation. They say God has said this and God hasn't said a thing. Therefore, extortion is right. Robbery is epidemic. The poor and the needy are abused. The outsider and the immigrants are kicked around at will, and there is no access to justice. So, first of all, we have a nominee being nominated for a seat that was stolen. And we have preachers that they claim for, you know, really because they want to roll back Roe versus Wade, but it's really deeper than that because they're really bought and paid for in some other ways. But they are going in and praying, P-R-A-Y, for a president who is praying, P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, on the very people that we as preachers are supposed to stand up for. So you got a stolen seat, stolen in a way we hadn't seen since the Civil War days. You have a whole bunch of people vetted by the Federalist Society, and they say he's not extreme. Well, if you got folk that are 900% extreme, and you pick the one that's 500% extreme, you really haven't done much.
I'm not sure that he isn't 900%
extreme. Well, that's right, when you really look at it.
So what role... So a lot of people feel helpless because of the Supreme Court. They feel like there's nothing they can do. The Republican Congress is going to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. What role can social movements play in fighting back against this? First, in terms of fighting back against the nomination, then if he gets on the court, what role can social movements play in trying to fight back then?
You know, one of the things we've said in the Poor People's Campaign is we have to find a way to have movements, not just and campaigns, not just events, and connect all of this, right? Connected when we talk about it, connected to systemic racism, connected to systemic poverty, ecological devastation, a war economy, and as we fight back, it's not always about stopping what they're going to do, as exposing what they're doing, so that people have that exposure as they engage in voting and as they engage in organizing, because people need to understand this time. And I know you've heard it, but for real, this time it's not about just the Democratic Party. It's about the soul of this democracy itself. The question, I mean, I've had some of my Jewish friends have said the thing they worry the most about Americans right now is we don't know what fascism looks like. We don't know what it looks like when it's in its embryo, you know, when it's built, and that really, this is the question before is America is, can America be? So if we're going to talk about Kavanaugh, I'm going to say something. Don't throw at me till you hear me finish. This cannot be just we're against him because he might roll back Roe versus Wade. You go down that path, you're going to lose the people. It has to be about Roe versus Wade, but you gotta add something to it. That rolling back Roe versus Wade is an attack on poor women. Right? Poor women who already make, you know, up 73% of the poor. Next, you have to examine his record on workers' rights and connect that. Because you have to examine his attitude towards immigrants, because he denied an abortion for not just anybody, an immigrant person, a Latino. Then we have to ask, and Democrats in the Senate are going to have to ask these questions, and it can't be just a black senator. Mr. Kavanaugh, do you consider Brown versus Board of Education settled law? Mr. Kavanaugh, do you consider the 15th Amendment settled law? And where do you stand on the Voting Rights Act and it being fully restored? Do you believe there is voter suppression? No. Name, explain to us, don't give him a yes, no question. Explain to us how you see voter suppression. We have to make him open his mouth in a fusion way so that people understand it's not just about Roe versus Wade, it's about the rollback of our fundamental values in this democracy. Mr. Kavanaugh. Mr. Kavanaugh, where do you stand on the 14th Amendment? Since right now Trump and others, his enablers in the Congress, are suggesting that immigrants don't have equal protection under the law, which it is clear that the 14th Amendment said anybody on this land has access to equal protection under the law. The 14th Amendment is in the middle of the amendments. It's the salvation of the Constitution. Without the 14th Amendment, the Constitution is nothing. It's not the, the Second Amendment. It's the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment that make the Constitution anything. Where do you stand, Mr. Kavanaugh? And so you want to make it so if you lose, he loses because he's exposed. And people can clearly see what happens when you don't vote. Because a lot of red states are not red. They are non-voting states. Where if we can get people fired up enough, even in the South. So, and then lastly, Ari, I'm going to say this carefully. I get pessimistic. I'm not always optimistic. I'm hopeful because I'm required to be hopeful. But there comes a time when you got to stop mourning and pick yourself up. And if somebody ever tells me again, this is the worst we've ever seen in America. Worse? You tired and folk had to fight against their people being killed and genocide of Native. We're tired already? We're tired and people fought 250 years against slavery and 100 years against Jim. Tired? You're tired and women had to fight like hell for the right to vote and 18-year-olds had to fight because they were sending them to war but they couldn't vote and we got the nerve to talk about tired. I'm tired of what I see happening, and I'm rested and ready to fight.
So we're going to let that sink in for a minute. I want to make a quick housekeeping note. The fellows, raise your hand, fellows, our amazing fellows.
Hey, fellows.
Where are they? Where are they? No, we're not doing that? Okay, sorry, we're not doing that. All right, we were going to take questions from fellows, but apparently we're not. So, okay, I'm just going to keep on rolling.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Bridget, are we closing out the podcast? No? Yeah. We closed out the podcast too?
All right, I brought
okay,
this.
Okay, two more questions. Huh? This is what it's improv... Okay. We're closing out the podcast, but we're not leaving yet. Okay. Right. Little improvisation here.
Ari, I brought this for you too. I want everybody to go get it. The speech that Frederick Douglass did 2 months after the Dred Scott decision, and everybody told him that abolition was over. And Frederick Douglass, we need to read what people had to do against worse odds. And Frederick Douglass talks about how no matter with all the odds and the Supreme Court against her, that the abolition movement wasn't dead, it was being reborn again. And the Poor People's Campaign, we had 40 days of action to launch a movement, not to end the movement. And now we have 40 coordinating committees in 40 states where people are going to be doing power building and voter registration and connecting these issues together. We're talking about a marathon and not a sprint. And you can't do this kind of organized. If you're concerned about the Supreme Court, you must mobilize for 218. But you can't just mobilize for 218. We need to register people for the movement who will vote. Not just register people who will vote one time. We need to register people for the movement who will vote. And we have to do like they did. They started a white Southern strategy 50-year plan. We need to recover the values of America, and deeper than the values of America, the deeper values of morality, our deepest religious and constitutional values, and have our own 50-year plan that's not just about one election. And the party can't do it. Parties can't do it because they are so committed to want the election and then they go home. We have to build money, build movements, and have funds to do that for movements that even after Election Day will continue to mobilize, particularly in impacted communities.
Okay, I finally got my housekeeping instructions. So people are going to be coming around, our fellows are going to be coming around with questions. So if you have questions, give them to the fellows when they come around. And secondly, we are closing out the podcast part of the show. So we need everyone to give Reverend Barber a big round of applause for the podcast. Do that now.
Wait. Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much for being here, Reverend Barber.
Thank you.
But this is not over. That was just for all the people that are going to listen to this great conversation on the podcast. So we're going to do a few more questions, then take Q&A. So one of the things you said when you were in North Carolina was that Democrats and progressives had to pay more attention to what was happening at the state level. That movements were built from the state level up, not the other way around. Do you feel like that message has sunk in 2018 with Indivisible, with so many people running for local offices, with so many people paying attention to what's happening in the states now?
Well, I'm excited about a lot of what I'm saying. I was listening to the young people in the fight against guns, and they started using moral language, and people are starting to hear statewide. Every progressive revolutionary progress in this country began from bottom up, from Selma up, from Birmingham up, from Berkeley up, right? Up. And we made a mistake, progressives did, when we started searching for Messiah candidates at the federal level, and the Koch brothers and others decided they were gonna build a movement from the bottom up. Now, where did they get the idea from? Dr. King. Dr. King, in his speech on the March on Washington, never told us, go back to D.C. He said, go back to Alabama, go back to Mississippi. He was outlining a state up movement. So I'm glad to see it, Ari, but it's not totally sunk in yet, because some people politically are still talking about a way, you know, this way to victory, or just how to elect, you know, just enough, rather than in terms of fighting for the whole country, particularly the South. Part of the Poor People's Campaign's work is going to be particularly those southern states, Kansas, no company. Now, California, don't mishear what I'm saying. We're doing the 40 states, but we're going to ask some people in California to help come, because what happens in these southern states impacts you in California. We have to break that southern, block, right? And it's possible. I think, Ari, you may have written something on it, and I know Ben Jealous and others did. If you registered 30% of the unregistered black voters in the South and added that to progressive whites and Latinos, about five southern states are no longer quote-unquote red, whatever that means. I mean, they can be transformed. You can't keep giving away 170, 180 electoral votes. We have to build, but not only do we have to build from the state, because most of the stuff that's bad is happening in our state capitals. Federal government didn't pass as much anything. Denial of health care, state. Denial of living wages, state. Suppression of voting rights, state. Racialized gerrymandering, state. Attacks on immigrants, state and federal, but the state law. Many of the negative attacks on gay people at the state level. So we have to build resistance. That's why the Poor People's Campaign for 40 days, we asked them, all of our coordinating committee, to have actions every Monday at State House. And it kind of freaked some people out, because the first day, we are trended on Twitter across the world, because what happened was at 2 o'clock East Coast, then at 2 o'clock in the Central, it happened, then the West, and media was saying, what's happening? Something's going across the state, country. And what we were doing, over 4,000 people presented themselves for civil disobedience, over 40-week people, period. That's never happened before in the history of this country at state houses simultaneously. Now, some people who miss it say, well, they just got arrested. Mm-mm. We had over 35 million Twitter impressions. We've had an enormous amount of traffic and people signing up to now want to do voter registration, power building. You see, there's a method to the madness. So, Ari, yes, the answer to your question is simply is yes, I'm excited, but we have to do it even the more.
And how do you think that Trump can be defeated in 2020 in a way that he wasn't in 2016? How can your message stick in a way that it may not have in 2016?
Well, I think when we talk about, first of all, we have to organize now. We have to build out now. We have to, and we cannot, if progressives want to win, they cannot leave people out of the conversation. So if progressives, want to win. And they don't want to deal not with the words of racism, but the works of racism. Stop getting all excited about Roseanne Barr and talk about the judges that are being appointed to the federal bench. That's racism. Stop having a fetish over Russia. I don't know what Russia did. Let Mueller do his investigation, but deal with America's own problems, and that is voter suppression and gerrymandering, and call it out. Stop allowing people to hide behind, well, I disagree with the rhetoric. Yes, but where do you vote? That's what we want to know. But if you're going to win, you cannot keep talking about the middle class and not say anything about the 140 million poor and low wealth people. If people don't hear their name and see their face, they're not moved to vote. And progressives, you can't just win with facts. We have to put a face on the pain. And then lastly, you can't just be against Trump. And I'm going to say something, and this is not Bernie's agenda or Warren's. It is an agenda that actually comes out of the Bible for me, because justice is a biblical issue. So if progressives want to win, tell America, if you elect us, we're for automatic voter registration at 18. We're for early voting in every state. We're for Election Day as a holiday. We're for restoring the Voting Rights Act. We're for tribal recognition for First Nation people and the Alaskan Natives. We're for federal and state living wages. We're for a right for all workers and farm workers to have and join union. We are for equal pay for equal work. We are for guaranteed basic incomes for the poorest among us. We are for free tuition at public colleges and universities. We are for equitable funding for historically black colleges and universities. We are not just for the Obamacare, affordable care. We want single-payer universal health care for everybody as a human right. We want fair and decent housing. We want a moral budget. We want 100% clean and renewable energy. We want a right to clean water, clean land, and clean air. We want a ban on fracking, a ban on mountaintop removal of coal. We want a ban on new pipelines and refineries. And we want to end militarism, aggressive militarism, and stop the privatization of the military budget. We want an end to the ban for assault weapons. And we want to challenge the distorted moral narrative of religious nationalism. Tell America what we're about. Give America a dream again, a hope again, a vision again. Not just we're against Trump, but we're for a better America. And if America doesn't want that, then that will be America's test of whether she wants to be America. But give America a real choice. That's what we have to do. And one other thing, don't say it's not possible. And if you're going to run for office, Democrats, progressives, don't run on that agenda. And then when you get elected, back up on that agenda and simply be Republican light. And I'm not preaching for the Democrat party. I'm talking about a transformation. And stop saying what's possible, because 100 years ago, everything we enjoy now, people said was impossible. No.
So we have a few more minutes, and I want to get to a few of these questions, and there's kind of a general theme.
You mind if I stand up?
Of course. You don't have to ask permission from me. So how, there's a general theme to a lot of these questions, which is, how can people help make this agenda possible? And particularly, what can you do to get people out to vote who are discouraged by both parties, who are fed up with the system, who are suffering from a lot of the things you're talking about, but feel like it's never going to get fixed, so why bother?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. I think, again, I want to invite people to sign up for Action 90975, the Poor People's Campaign, the movement of it, of that campaign, because I think we have to have, we have to change the narrative first before we're going to move people. We have to have a fundamental change in narrative. I'm asking media to help us change the narrative right versus left. And people say, well, why? Because why would I stand up here and call somebody right and in 30 minutes try to convince you they're wrong? It's extremism. Why do we give equal moral authority to positions that are not equal? Right? You know, left versus right, conservative versus liberal. How do we call people conservative that don't even conserve the Constitution? It, you know, when you're against voting rights, that's not a conservative position. That's an extreme position. So at some point, we're going to have to loose the narrative and redirect the narrative. And it will be work, but it has to be done. Number two, we have to be willing to go to people in a movement, not just as a party, in the places where people have been ignored. I was in Harlan County. And folks said, you can't go to Harlan County. I said, well, why not? Because it's 89% Trump. I said, but people will drink dirty water till they get clean water. So we went to Harlan County. On a Tuesday, I think it was, had 400 or 500 people to show up, white, black, coal miners, people from Louisville, people from Eastern Kentucky. They, in the Poor People's Campaign, they said this to me, Reverend, nobody talks to us. No, they didn't say Democrat, Republican, nobody talks to us. And they're organized. We went to West Virginia. We've been in Alabama. We've been all the way over in Washington State. I know we're in California. I'm just talking about some of the other places. In Aberdeen, that has the highest, the zip code with the highest number of homeless millennials in America. We have to go like Star Trek, where others and discover that there's a whole group of people. And we not don't offer them a party. Talk about these agenda. Talk about the need to transform. Meet them where they are. Invite them to be people in a movement who will vote, not just people who vote and then you walk away from them. And then show this. When we had the Poor People's Campaign, I had a lot of people that, I mean, when we had the launch, the final day of the launch on the 23rd, and we had 25,000 people who were the original, we called them the original founders of the 21st Century Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. All right, people have been asking me this question. I said, well, Reverend Barber, we know you can be kind of long-winded. But on that day, you didn't speak but 7 minutes. And they said, well, why is that? Why didn't you just go all out? I said, you didn't hear what we said. We said we were going to create a stage for the impacted people to speak. So what we did was we pushed the people who live it in front of me. When the union leaders got up, they didn't speak. They brought the workers. If we can put that fusion face, if we can, the only way we can beat this narrative, friends, that poverty is a black, brown, lazy folk thing, is we got to get black and brown and white people who are poor together on the stage to speak to the heart of America. We have to show people that the same people that attack voting rights use the voter suppression to get elected, and then they pass laws that hurt everybody. That's the conversation we're going to have so that people can say, and it's 140 million more people like me out there? Mm-hmm. And you mean that we don't even need all of us? In some of these states, a 1% increase can turn them around. Have fundamental transformation. So I believe we've got to go to people. The movement has to go to people. It's not going to be just done through TV. It's not just going to be done through ads. We've got to go into places. When I was in Harlan County, for instance, at the end of the day, two guys came up to me and said, Reverend Barber, I'm Hatfield and I'm McCoy. And I said, okay. And they said, no, we're in the movement. And he said to me, there are a whole lot of people up here in these hollows of these mountains that can hear this message. We went to Alabama. We met women and black people and white, but black people who have raw sewage in the back of their yards 50 some years after the march to Montgomery. and they're in. That's what King meant. You got to have a new unsettling force. You got to have a whole group of people who, as one of my good friends from Appalachia said, our backs are against the wall and we have nothing else to do but push back. That is the only coalition of black and white and brown and native and immigrant and Latino poor people with moral leaders and with advocates and people who have wealth and conscience. That's the coalition that's got to come together and help move people to the polls. So for instance, in August, we're starting 2 days on the second weekend in August and the last weekend in August, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And we're going into communities with poor people's shirts on, impact the communities, places where people are registered, but they haven't voted because they're so disenchanted. We're not inviting them to vote for a party. We're inviting them to become movement members who vote. And that's a difference. But people, if they ever join a movement and vote because of the movement, then they will be more likely to stay engaged. If they just vote for a party when the party disappoints them, then they many times will go home.
So we're going to have to wrap up in a second, unfortunately. I could listen to you talk all day, but we're going to have to wrap up in a second. But I just want to ask you, lastly, two things. One, what would your call to action be to people in this room? And then secondly, what role can journalism play in making these things that you're talking about possible?
Well, again, the Poor People's Campaign 50 years ago was murdered. Today, as we revive it, not as something, we didn't do this because it was the 50th year. That's not why. I want you to know this is not a commemoration. This is a call to action. This is a re-engagement. Because America cannot continue to function and be what she at least claims to be until we deal seriously with systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the distorted moral narrative of religious nationalism. And we need a remnant. Amos chapter 5 says, God says, I need a remnant. I don't need everybody, but I need a remnant who will close down the factories, close down the streets, and cry in the public square until the nation's heart is transformed. We need a whole group of folk who are willing to engage in helping to change the moral narrative, who are willing to engage in mass moral fusion, nonviolent civil disobedience, and who are willing to engage in massive power building among poor and impacted people. In the days to come, we're going to make some calls. You know, we did this thing 40 days and every Monday, and I told you the people that got arrested, but we're not through. There's going to come a time, I believe, that we're going to have to send out a call. And in order to push these issues where they ought to be, we may have to shut down the major streets of every major city in this country. But it can't just be going out there cussing and arguing. It's got to be agenda-based. It's got to be deeply moral and deeply nonviolent so that people don't use it against us. It's got to be fusion together. It has to be, you're not going to separate us, right? It can't be just about Trump. Move Trump tomorrow, you get Pence. Move Trump tomorrow, you still have Ryan and McConnell, who agree with 99% of his agenda. They just know how to do it quieter. So that's not the issue. Just, even though I want him to be moved, and I want an election where he's moved, but we have to move the consciousness of the nation. And so I'm asking you to find your way to link up with this movement. Now notice I didn't say join an organization, because it's not about building another organization. We're not trying to put all the organization under the Poor People's Campaign. We're saying, watch this room. How many people are in different organizations? Okay, how many people in here agree that we have to deal with systemic racism, real policy racism? Okay, now how many people in here agree that we have to deal with systemic poverty? Okay, how many people here agree that we have to deal with ecological devastation? How many people in here agree that we have to deal with the war economy and militarism? Where we have, I mean, we put 15 cents of every discretionary dollar into education and infrastructure, but 53 cents of every discretionary dollar into war and militarism. Something's wrong. Now, how many of you agree that we can't just deal with one of those things, but we have to deal with all of them? You see what I'm saying? Now, I didn't ask anybody to join an organization. And there are thousands, millions of people just like you. And it's time that we understand that people don't cheat you if they can beat you in a straight fight. So if folk had to lie every other minute, put $10 billion, some say, Jim Nichols, who wrote that book on dollarocracy, it's like, these pornographic sums of money, had to do gerrymandering, voter suppression, and go to Russia to just get an electoral win, that's not a sign of their strength, that's a sign of our strength and their weakness. Right? Now, media, on the media side, we thank God for Mother Jones. Thank God for Ari Berman. You know, somebody probably said, man, Ari, nobody's going, I mean, his book should be all that the media is talking about right now. Not just voters of Russia, but he wrote it. He wrote it, and we have it. And thank God for those that do the articles that other people won't do. Now what we need is you to keep doing it. We need you to remember that every prophetic movement, my Jewish friends will know what I'm talking about, every prophetic movement always has a Baruch. Jeremiah had a scribe, right? So you have to have scribes. You have to have, in every age, a dissenting moral voice that doesn't dissent because, that doesn't work, that says, I may not win the vote, but I'm still not going to give up the principle. Secondly, you have to help us change the language. We got to start calling people extremists and not just right and left, right? And then thirdly, as a preacher, the way in which this so-called Christian nationalism is so funded and so embedded and worked its way all the way up into the White House to where Paula White, the other, they had the nerve to say Jesus really wasn't on the side of the immigrants. And that if Jesus, when he and his family went across the border to Egypt, that it was legal. Because if it wasn't legal, he would have sinned and he couldn't have been our savior. It's okay. But that's who's advising our president. We need the media to help us. And Liz Theo Harris, Dr. Yvette Flunder, Dr. Liz Theo Harris, Jonathan Hartgrove, and myself just wrote a book called, I mean, an article called The Hijacking of Evangelicalism. And we've issued a call for a truth debate. We want Jeffers, Falwell, Graham, and Paula White. In love and in truth, we want them on a TV set. And because there's a battle for morality in this country, and we're tired of people standing up saying that or suggesting this is a moral or a Christian perspective when it is neither. And we need media like Mother Jones to join that call. Call for a public debate and conversation with them. They can no longer be allowed to hide behind the money. And no longer be allowed to claim they're carrying the moral agenda. And I don't even say that from hate. Because I cry sometimes, Ari, and pity folk who get taught a warped form of religion like the slave masters were that causes them to wake up in the morning wanting to know who can they hurt next. I mean, it's something sad about that. That you get taught that some kind of way. And you wake up in the morning and like Jeffers told Trump at the inaugural sermon, Mr. President, you have the divine authority to build walls. And he used some misquote of Nehemiah. You have the divine. And you say, you know, People get up in the morning, let's see how many people I can take health care from. Let's see how many gay folk I can hate. Let's see how many guns I can preserve, because gun rights is tantamount to a moral position and a divine right. God, when you know the hurt that kind of heresy has caused down through the ages, it causes you to feel a sense of pity for the people who are being misled by the leaders. And it's high time that we call it out. And we no longer run from it. But if we ought to say, brother and sister White, Falwell, Graham, Jeffers, if you want a moral debate in this country, bring it on, baby. We ready for it. Bring it on. Bring it on.
Unfortunately, that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much, Reverend Barber. Everyone, please give him a big round of applause.
God bless you all. Forward together. Forward together. Forward together. Not one step back. Not one step back. I will join the movement. I will register people to vote. I will vote. And we will never, 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 never give up on the heart and the soul of this democracy. God bless you.
All right, but before...